Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United on the air, coming at you live. Tonight we have actors Bill Cobbs and Michael Berryman. Surprising conversation with Michael Berryman in particular. But they're in the new film, The Tenant, which is now available on DVD. There's a link on our webpage where you can order it. But that's not all. We also have the first reports coming from the New York Film Festival. So we'll hear some advance word from our good buddy Dean Treadway on that event. He's live on the scene. I wish I had like a sound of a chopper.
That would be good. That would be good for
what's
Dean.
What's it look like out there, Dean?
Well, Jamie.
Yeah. So how are you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. You know, we have, as we before the show, there's moments before we go on. I said we had some interesting stuff to talk about because, you asked what had come out this weekend. And yesterday was kind of an interesting day because I saw the film that destroyed Darren Aronofsky's relationship to Rachel Weisz. But I don't know if he really should feel that bad. Because then I watched Black Swan again last night. That was on Cinemax. It came on. And, God, that film is so awesome. And I feel vindicated because I tell people it's the female version of Fight Club, and I'm now more than ever convinced of that after last night's viewing. But watching it, Dreamhouse though, I know why they got these Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz, obviously fell in love and got married in this movie. There's nothing going on in the movie. I mean, they must have been bored out of their goddamn minds.
I bet they were. I mean, the movie didn't have any advanced screenings for critics. They wanted critics to stay the heck away from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't blame them. And whoever cut the trailer should be fired because, I mean, we've seen this movie many times before, whether it's Number 23. That was the first thing that actually came to mind while watching it. But we've seen this movie before many times. And in the trailer, though, they give the whole movie away. Not that there's really... It wouldn't surprise you anyways, but you really walk in, you sort of know what's going to happen. It's the only thing that I guess you could say that is the suspense is why. And even when you realize that, you're just like, whatever. But it's just really just kind of uninvolved filmmaking.
Jim Sheridan.
Yeah. I think Get Rich or Die Trying is a better movie in hindsight. I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, it's just, I was really surprised. But the thing I find interesting, though, is in between the two Bond films. I mean, Daniel Craig has really not made wise choices at all. He was making riskier choices before Casino Royale, before Quantum of Solace, but it seems like here, I don't know, these are really not great. These are really bad. These are not smart choices. Obviously, the girl with the dragon tattoo, I mean, he's born to play that part. That's a no-brainer. But outside of the two big properties, the other films are just lackluster, to say the least. I'm surprised, though. It's now becoming, it's not a fluke. It's you see this with The Invasion, The Golden Compass, this film, and even Cowboys. I know Cowboys and Aliens look like a surefire hit when they're probably making it and casting it, but and of all these, I think the most interesting choice he's made is Defiance in this series.
Right.
And I don't even think that's a great film, but I at least think that's the most interesting so far. And I think this is something that's, wow, is he going to have this curse after, you know, he's done playing
Bond
or whatever?
I don't know. I mean, Pierce Brosnan made some interesting choices in between.
He's still making interesting, I mean,
yeah.
the Matador and Taylor of Panama especially.
Right, right.
But it's interesting, though. It's something to take in, think about.
Maybe Girl with a Dragon Tattoo will change it for him.
I think so.
Don't know. I don't think a lot about Daniel Craig. I mean, he's generally not on my radar.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. Before, though, let's say before Casino Royale, you have Layer Cake, you have Sylvia, you have The Mother, Enduring Love, which is just an incredible performance. I mean, these are all, with the exception of Layer Cake. Layer Cake is the one that you could obviously say, okay, this guy could play James Bond. But the others are such diverse performances. And also the other one he did, the other Capote movie, Infamous.
Yeah,
great in that. And it's really interesting. And now it seems like once he's played, I mean, he's an incredible James Bond. I would say he rivals Connery in the part. But it just seems like now that he's just taking stuff and it's like it's beneath him, even though it's obviously more expensive. The productions are more expensive and more lavish. The movies are truly beneath him. And it's just something to think about.
Well, maybe he needs a new agent.
I think
he definitely
needs a new agent.
I mean, I was talking about this the other night, how I think that Infamous is the superior Capote movie.
I agree.
Yeah. But, you know, but then again, I think Moneyball's one of the best of the year, and it's the same filmmaker, so I'm not poo-pooing on the filmmaker.
Fascinating. I mean, Moneyball's absolutely just a fascinating film, as is The Social Network, and they take you leave it to someone like Sorkin, he can make anything.
Mm-hmm.
He can just make anything just riveting, and that's the Moneyball does that too, like The Social Network, and
yeah.
I think Moneyball is just in its own way such an inspiring movie. The character and Pitt, you know, Pitt just never always amazes me. He just gets better and better every year.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Pitt because there's an argument going on whether or not Pitt is, you know, a movie star. So we'll talk about that.
Okay, no,
in a
that's
little bit.
Fine.
Let's bring on Dean. He's at the New York Film Festival up there. Hey, Dean.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you, man?
I'm pretty good. It's my third day here at the festival, and it's been pretty overcast here, very rainy, but it's been quite, all the Yankees games got rained out, I think, and it's been quite fine so far.
I can smell the subway urine from the telephone.
Yes, it's wafting up from the grates, it's good. You know, I haven't gotten too deep into the festival yet. This coming week is really when it's really going to get more serious because so far I've only seen three films since Friday.
Okay.
And then I'll see my fourth one tonight at 9. And by the way, just to let anybody know, if you're interested in checking out what the festival has to offer, just go to www.filmlink, that's filmlinc.com. And you can check out the many offerings. It's just extraordinary what they have in the 49th Film Festival this year. This is the 49th one. Next year will be, of course, the 50th. And
that's
going to
be enormous.
Even bigger.
Okay, so what have you seen so far?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I have written two reviews of what I've seen, and so I'm going to do something a little unusual. I've never done this before on this show. I'm actually going to read you a couple of very short reviews, and it'll be a lot more succinct than me just talking about them because I think two of these movies really deserve reviews. So
okay,
I'm going to start off with a Turkish film called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which I saw on Friday. And so here's my review. At the beginning of Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, we see three police cars burning up a lonely road curving through the Turkish countryside. The worn-out lawmen and these vehicles have two chastened murder suspects in tow, and all are in the midst of a seemingly impossible search for where the two suspects have buried their victim. The accused, however, were drunk at the time of their crimes and cannot recall exactly where the corpse is buried. And so begins this mysterious, haunting examination into the evil that lies in wait in the hearts of all men. Riding along with the police is a troubled doctor assigned to the autopsy, as well as a grandstanding police inspector played by the charismatic Tanner Bursell. These two characters struggle with their own past as they attempt to wind their way through this frustrating case. And along the way, director Nuri Bilge Ceylan treats us to a unique blend of film noir, gallows humor, and existential dread. Photographed in stunning widescreen by Gökhan Tiryaki, this winner of the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival sports a plethora of indelible images. The burnished yellow glare of car headlights trying to shed light on the truth, an errant apple falling from a tree and then floating down a stream to join a batch of rotten fruit, the careful lantern-lit steps of a brown-eyed nymph carrying a tea tray, looking like some sort of beautiful ghost, an accused killer lost in the horror of what he's done, and a vigilant dog growling on a lonely hillside. By the film's unspeakably sobering final third, Ceylan turns his camera on the accusers, who start to realize that they've committed their own smaller misdeeds in the past. With this, his third film, after Climate and Three Monkeys, Ceylan, who has a growing cult surrounding his work, cements his place as a methodical observer of crimes both big and small. Anatolia is a masterwork in the truest sense. This film does have distribution. It has landed distribution, so it will be possible to see this on the big screen, which I would recommend if it does come to your city, that you take the chance to see it, because it really has a lot in common dialogue-wise with even something like Tarantino. But it has a methodical pace. Mm-hmm. It's never boring, though. It's never boring, and it's always concerned with what goes. You could make some comparisons with this movie to Heat, because it's kind of about, you know, how criminals need police and police need criminals in order to do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And how there's not much difference from the two in
right.
some ways.
Right.
And
it's
quite great.
Climax, yes. And Distant is the first film I saw by him, or I guess it's the native title, Yuzak. But I like Distant a lot, and Climax was very good too. I've never seen Three Monkeys, but I'll definitely look for that. But this one sounds
right.
incredible. This just sounds really good. I mean,
it won the Grand Jury Prize, which means it came in second to Tree of Life this year at Cannes. So, and I think I could see where they might have had a little bit of difficulty picking between the two, because seriously, Anatolia, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is absolutely one of the best things I've seen this year, and hopefully a lot of other people will get to see it on the big screen where it deserves to be seen.
Right. Which do you like of the two? If you had to choose between this and Tree of Life, which would you have chosen?
Well, I think that Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is a lot more entertaining. But Tree of Life is obviously more important, more ambitious, and a lot more successful, I think. You know, but it's really like, you know, comparing, you know, one orange to another. It's like,
right. Okay, it's a fair question. I mean,
yeah.
It just sounds like the subject matter. I might have picked the Turkish film over Tree of Life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a much more accessible film. Let's just face it. I mean, you know, the Tree of Life is largely an experimental film. Although
mm-hmm.
I have to say, you know, I've seen Tree of Life now three times, and each time I see it, I notice more threads in it that are important
mm-hmm.
and things that I'd never noticed in it before. And
right.
And I think that it's an incredibly rich movie that cannot possibly be absorbed in just one sitting. So
I haven't even seen it once yet. And you know, I have it here, but I have it on DVD. So I'm thinking, should I wait for the Blu-ray, or should I just go ahead and watch it?
Oh, I would watch it once and then just go ahead and watch it again on Blu-ray, because I guarantee you the second time you watch it, the first time you watch Tree of Life, you'll be overwhelmed by it all. And the second time you watch it, you won't be overwhelmed by where it's going. You'll know where it's already going, and you'll be able to see the threads that go through it and that really link everything together in very unconventional ways.
Well, okay. All right, then I'll break out the Vienna sausages and sit down tonight and watch it.
Let me just tell you, I saw another film called Sleeping Sickness really quickly. I didn't write a review of it. I liked it. I didn't go nuts for it. It's from a German filmmaker named Ulrich Kohler. It's about two European doctors, one white and one black, who travel to Cameroon in Africa to address a sleeping sickness epidemic. And it's about their very unusual reactions to Africa and how Africa sort of ends up kind of possessing them. It has very obvious shades of Heart of Darkness. You know, the Joseph Conrad novel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And with the white doctor sort of taking the place of Colonel Kurtz and. And the black doctor taking the place of
Marlowe.
Captain Willard. Yeah.
Or Marlowe. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kurtz is Marlon Brando, and then, you know, Captain Willard.
Right. No, I was just going because you mentioned the original Conrad story, so.
Oh, right.
And Marlowe is the Willard character in the.
Well, right. I'm also bringing in Apocalypse Now.
Right.
So, yeah, which it also references visually in a lot of ways. But in surprising ways. And the two lead performances are quite good. The movie has an unusual structure to it, and a slightly cliched ending that owes a lot to somebody like a Pete Pong Weerasethakul from Thailand. But and it's probably a movie. You know, when you go to the New York Film Festival, you can bet that 20% of the movies that you see on the main slate are not going to get distribution. And this is one of those movies that I think, you know, will be a hard movie to see for most people. But of course, it'll eventually be available on home video if you're interested in it, and it's very good. But you know, when you see something like Anatolia afterwards, you kind of like go, oh wow, this is the kind of thing we could be seeing, could be in for the rest of the couple of weeks that the festival is going on. The festival is going on, by the way, until the 16th, Sunday, October 16th.
Okay, so let's hear real quick about the George Harrison, and then hear what else you have in your slate next week.
Okay, this is my review of the Harrison movie. Going into George Harrison, living in the material world, you know that Scorsese's biodoc of the notoriously quiet Beatle is going to be pure catnip for lovers of both movies and music, especially considering the director's last foray into this territory, the excellent Bob Dylan No Direction Home. But nothing can really prepare you for how truly extraordinary this film is. In short, it is utter bliss. Using scads of never-before-seen footage from Harrison's archives, including private films, photos, and videos that Harrison himself had shot, Scorsese and his collaborators have crafted an inventively structured, vividly illustrated chronicle of this artist's travels through Beatledom and beyond, with a special concentration on his eventual spiritual awakening, which touched everyone and everything that came into Harrison's circle. Scorsese breathed such life into each stage of this tale, this familiar tale, that it will appeal to diehard fans who will feel they've never heard this story before, and Harrison novices who will be instantly captivated by the man's humor, compassion, truthfulness, and musical prowess. There are many moments to adore in this movie. The roughhousing with John, Paul, and Ringo, a visit seaside with his musical mentor, Ravi Shankar, revealing views of his idiosyncratic UK estate, Friar Park, Patty Harrison's recounting of her breakup with George, alternating with lines from the song Isn't It a Pity, Tom Petty laughing about George's insistence that he learn to play the ukulele, Harrison's lively foray into movie production, starting with Monty Python's Life of Brian, and heartbreakingly Olivia Harrison's remembrances of both George's battle with cancer and the shocking attack they both suffered at the hands of a deranged schizophrenic. Most notably, though, Material World infuses every one of the viewer's cells with the light and love that George Harrison gave freely to the world. The film is not only Scorsese's best work in two decades, it is the spiritually inquisitive director's most ethereally uplifting work ever. It is the giving essence of an essential artist reawakened and revived.
Wow. Wow.
Really?
Okay.
Great.
Well, that airs next week on HBO.
Right. It's over two nights.
When's
the DVD release? Is the DVD release right upon it as well?
I'm not sure.
So wait, when does this come on? When does this come on HBO?
During the week. I don't know what days. Maybe Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Cool. Just got to send it to the PR.
I think it's somewhere around the 10th. I'm sure you can Google it and figure it out. But it's great. The songs in it are remastered. We saw it in the new Eleanor Bonham theater that's newly added to Lincoln Center, and it felt like we were at a rock concert. The sound of the songs, they just never sounded this way before. We were treated to a Skype press conference with Scorsese and Olivia Harrison, and the producer and the editor and the interviewer there as well. That was done from the UK, and that was quite informative. I wish I could share that with the viewers. I have to tell you, I looked at the faces of everyone in the audience who's watching the film, and I could just feel everyone just loving every moment of it. I mean, this 4 hours or 3.5 hours or whatever it is just went by like 5 minutes. It was so great. It was absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Now, tonight I go and see at 9 o'clock, I go see the recently restored version of Nicholas Ray's last movie, which was from 1975, and it's called We Can't Go Home Again. Later on this week, as far as the press screenings go, I wasn't able to get into Carnage, unfortunately. I'd missed that, but later on this week I'll be seeing, amongst the films I'll be seeing, will be Cronenberg's Dangerous Method, Bruce Sanofsky and Joe Berlinger's Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory, and there'll be press conferences in back of both of those. Then the next day I'll be seeing Elizabeth Olsen in Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which is officially my favorite title to say of the year.
Right.
And Thursday I'll be seeing Michael Fassbender once again in Steve McQueen's Shame, which should be quite interesting to report on. I'll also be seeing Wim Wenders' 3D documentary about modern dancer called Pina. And then on Sunday, October 9th, I'll be seeing Michelle Williams and My Week with Marilyn. And also tomorrow night, I'll be finally seeing Lars von Trier's new movie, Melancholia.
That's the one to see. That's really awesome. Yeah.
And I'm also going to be, taking some time out to go and see some movies that just got released, most notably Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret, which I just cannot wait to see. You know, I'm just so I don't know why I'm so excited about Margaret, because I know it's getting mixed reviews, but I love a movie that could divide audiences, and I also like movies that have slightly unlikable main characters, and I like Kenneth Lonergan's You Can Count on Me. Like, I think that's one of the great movies of the decade,
of
the last decade.
Yeah, magnificent movie. Yeah, I read the review in New York Magazine of that, and like you said, wildly mixed reviews. It seems like the first half of the movie he liked, and the second half just went off the rails.
Yeah, it seems like the main plot of the movie it gets bogged down with characters that are not central to the main story, and I think that sounds like what a lot of people have problems with.
First of all, the background of the movie is that it's taken so many years to get complete, something like 6 years, and the studio sued, and because they said that he would never finish a cut of it, and it was just endlessly tinkered with, and a lot of people are just, they look at Anna Paquin, who's the lead in the movie, and she's noticeably younger, pre-True Blood and all of that. But I think it really depends, too, upon whether or not you can tolerate that lead character, whether or not you find depth in her character or you just think she's a shallow, privileged girl. Because Keith Ulich's review of it was glowing, and he found a lot more depth in that character first than the New York Magazine review did.
And you could kind of feel everybody taking sides on this movie, and I kind of love that. Like, that's the kind of movie I want to see. I want to see a movie that forces you to take a side, whether you're for it or against it, because I often think those are the movies that are just the best, that are just alive with some kind of electricity that I can't put my finger on.
Okay, are you going to attend? I don't know if it happened yet or not. Are you going to attend that Pauline Kael event?
I'm going to try to. I have a friend. I made a really good friend that over here that can. It's possible that I'll be able to get into some events that press might not be able to get. Normal press might not be able to get into. I won't go into the details, but I got lucky and I made a friend here that has a path that can get me into a lot of things. So I'm going to try to get into things like, the Pauline Kael event. Actually, I will be out of town by that point because it happens on Sunday the 16th. So I'll be out of town by the 14th. I'm really going to try to get into, the 10th anniversary screening of the Royal Tenenbaums on Thursday the 13th, which has a reunion of most of the cast. I'm going to try to go to the Apple Store to see people like Antonio Banderas, whom I understand is going to be on the show soon to promote the Almodovar movie, right?
Yes.
And I'll be seeing the Almodovar movie next week, so he'll be at the Apple Store on Thursday the 13th at 5 p.m. And they're having it's when you go to the website, which again is filmlink.com, link with a C, you'll be able to see the massive number of very interesting movies that are not on the main slate, including a lot of great documentaries like The Ballad of Mott the Hoople, and Corman's World about Roger Corman. But also you'll be able to see, the kinds of, talks that are being given, and the special repertory screenings, like the 21st anniversary of Salvador, which will be attended by James Woods and Oliver Stone, or
Oliver Stone backed out on showing his any part of his Showtime miniseries there because he says it's not done yet.
Yeah,
or it's not ready to be shown.
Yeah, so he offered Salvador up as a sort of a replacement,
He should probably offer Salvador up for a replacement for a lot of the current movies he's been making.
Yeah, exactly. But
all right, so we might be back. We might be back Wednesday, but we'll definitely be back next Sunday for a wrap up. But if we're back Wednesday, let's get a midweek report.
Okay, that sounds good to me. And I'm gonna take off now and have me a nice dinner before I go off to see the Nicholas Ray movie. And so I'll keep you guys abreast of everything that's going on here.
Okay, cool. Thank
keep
you
me
so
abreast.
Much, Gene. Have a good time. Enjoy yourself.
I'm having a good time already. So
good to hear.
It's a really terrific, exciting film festival. So.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you Wednesday night.
All right, sounds good.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, Dean Treadway from the New York Film Festival reporting on the festival for us. You know why I asked about Pauline Kael? I just finished reading her her biography that comes out at the end of the month. She's fascinating. It's really interesting to read the arguments that went back and forth between her and the director she admired /
mm-hmm.
criticized. And
right.
The whole Paulette's thing, who followed her,
mm-hmm.
who dared to betray her. And there's a lot of stuff on there about the New York Film Festival and her involvement in that.
Oh, cool.
It's an interesting book, and also interesting because it asks questions of, you know, what's the danger of a film critic cuddling up with filmmakers, you know?
Well, it is a very slippery slope. You know, how can you, if the thing is, you know, the bias, the judgment and everything, you know, that's a fascinating thing to get into. So, I mean.
Yeah, and it got her into some trouble. Okay, so let's play our first interview tonight. We'll start out with actor Bill Cobbs. Both of our guests tonight are in the new film called The Tenant, which is now available on DVD. You can order it from the link here on our page that we provided in the description of the show tonight. Bill Cobbs is a great character actor. His first film was in 1974, I believe it was. It was The
mm-hmm.
Taking of Pelham 123, and he's made great films ever since. Stuff like Night at the Museum and on and on and on, and lots of memorable TV. And his last great movie for me was Get Low with Robert Duvall. He was
right.
an essential
mm-hmm.
part of that. So Mr. Cobbs spoke to us about acting, how he got into it, and what he gets out of it.
All right,
I guess that's as good a description as any.
Yeah.
Here is Bill Cobbs. I was curious what attracted you to acting, kind of what it fulfilled in you.
Well, actually, I've always been interested in doing something artistic. And music was the first interest I had, but I just never was able to, I wasn't able to get myself in a situation where I could do that. And so all through school, I would do different artistic things that in lieu of the music. But I went away for 8 years after I got out of school. I went into the Air Force. And during that time, I got involved in comedy. I did stand-up comedy on an amateur level.
Mm.
And I found that enjoyable. But really, when I got out of the service, I was out for 6 years, and I was working as a salesman. I was selling automobiles, and one of my customers came in for service one day and asked me if I'd like to do a play. And it sounded like it would be fun. It was just for 3 days, three performances. And once I did that, I found it so stimulating to get on the stage and perform. I went and auditioned for another play, and I got cast in a play called Early Victorious. It was written by Ossie Davis. And that play taught me that there were a lot of things I could say in theater, and on the stage, and in movies, and television, that were very important, that were meaningful things that, you know, that went in addition to being a means of entertaining people and touching them in different ways. There were things that you could say related to the human condition, and at the time, this was in 1969, it was a time when civil rights were one of the main concerns of the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
I found that we could do a play that dealt with civil rights, lack thereof, and in a comedy, which Pearl of Victorious was, and make some very important points, and at the same time be very entertaining, and in fact get us all to laugh at ourselves to some degree. So
yeah.
It was that experience that showed me the real importance and the power of theater, and also, of course, it was a means of being able to express my own concerns in particular, and a way of giving. I think to be an artist, you have to have a sense of giving. I believe most artists have that, regardless to their art. They create this thing that it's actually art is somewhat of a prayer, isn't it? We respond to what we see around us and what we feel and how things affect us physically, mentally, and spiritually. So it's not a brief answer, but.
It's absolutely a great answer. And the period of time where you came up in theater and film in the late 60s and 70s, I mean, that's generally considered, at least in terms of movies, the greatest decade for cinema. And I guess it must have something to do with, you know, we had gone through many assassinations, civil rights, the Vietnam War. As a country, as a world, we were dealing with a lot, and the artists at that time were portraying that. Did you sense that was a great time for artistic expression?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. In fact, I often share with people the fact that, you know, when I left, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, when I made my decision to get involved and to study the craft, to become an actor. And I went to New York, and it was a time when I had the least in my life as far as material things and money or anything. But it was the most exciting time of my life, and I've never been, I was never that happy before, and I've never been that happy again, because it was such an invigorating time, and it was a hopeful time. We all felt that, you know, we wanted to do something to make the world a better place. People even wrote songs about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We dealt with their things, just everything. Every taboo and every prejudice was tested. Unfortunately, they haven't all been conquered, but at least they were brought to the fore. I think we moved ahead quite a bit in those decades.
I mean, I look at those films from that period of time that we've been discussing, and I think those films were about something. I mean, they were grappling with issues, and I wish there was more of that today, because we could use it today. We're in an atmosphere of tremendous conflict today, and we could use the artist's voice out there.
Right. And I don't think we feel we don't experience it nearly as much now. Everything is so formulated. You know, if one movie does well, then we have to see five or six more just like that. You know, done in the same way or with the same kind of theme. And it's obviously more about the bucks now than about the content. And I'm sure that everyone else who does this has to feel that way too. And I know I talk to other actors and other artists, and they feel the same way. It's with sometimes what we have to do is not about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little discouraging.
you're obviously a working actor, so you want to work as much as possible. But occasionally, I'm sure one of these gems of a movie comes your way or a project. And the last film that I saw you in that really struck my heart was Get Low. I mean, was that a particularly special project for you to be involved in?
Oh, absolutely. That was really such a wonderful experience. It was as special as it turned out to be. The experience was as special as the final product, I think.
Well, you know, when I think of your performances, and I love you in everything that I see you in, I love the quality that you feel completely comfortable, and your characters feel completely lived in, and honest. And so when I think of Robert Duvall the same way. So I'm curious, when you're acting across from Duvall, what is that dynamic like for you?
Well, you know, that's interesting because people ask that often. And the funny thing is, the moment we met, we spoke, said hello, rehearsed the scene, and we were off and running. And I think I was far better prepared to work with Mr. Duvall than I might have been in some other situations, because you know, when you're about to work with somebody like that, you and just out of the very idea makes you feel as though you have to do much better than you might do at other times. That doesn't mean that I don't care about my work on other occasions, but it's such a challenge that you see, and so. It was just, you know, I often tell students and other people as well that the really good performers are usually the nicest people, and certainly Robert Duvall fits that. He's not a person who you're working with an actor. You're not working with a celebrity or a star. You see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same with the entire cast. It was just a situation, one of those great situations where everybody came with the same attitude. We're actors, we're professionals, and we have a job to do. And we did it with mutual respect for one another. And those are the kinds of experiences that I've been blessed to have when I work with the best people. It's not to put anybody down, I think.
Well, we had Robert Duvall on the show for Get Low, and in speaking to him about how he prepares for a role or a particular scene, it seemed that he was very non-fussy about it. And I find with actors that have been doing it a long time, you kind of learn to be more efficient in your approach. You don't have the urge to kind of throw in everything but the kitchen sink. You simplify. I mean, do you find that?
That's very true. I think that's what I was trying to say. When I said the best, and the really good ones are the best at just at that change. They prepare for what they have to do. They come prepared. They do it, and they're very, very respectful of everyone around them.
Mm-hmm.
We hear horror stories of people on the set and this issue's going on and that. I think that happens with people who are not quite, they don't quite have it together. The great people that I performed with, and there's so many of them, I was doing them justice to a lot of them if I started naming just a few. The real, real, real people are just people who love what they do, have respect for what they do, and they have a respect for their fellow actors and the people everyone else on the set as well, not just the actors, but the crew and the director and the producers and everyone comes with the same spirit, and that's when you see, usually that's when you see the really great projects come out.
Mm-hmm. And what do you need from a director to kind of facilitate that environment?
Trust and honesty. And I need for the director to trust me to do my job, and to be honest with me when I'm missing it, you know, just give me the direction. But at the same time, if I'm struggling in the very beginning, when we get started, you don't need a director to tell you the most basic things when you're just beginning, because you're feeling your way around, you know.
Right.
You sit there. So it's usually a really good director, I think, creates the atmosphere in which the people that he's chosen to do the parts can function. And if he does that, he usually does very well. And another thing with a good director, when he does have to give you a note, he doesn't go on and on and on. Once he says enough for you to understand what he's saying, he cuts it short. You know, he just makes it simple. Because,
yeah.
It doesn't take a whole lengthy. When you're working with directors who are just beginning, and particularly directors who haven't been actors, if they're just beginning, sometimes they'll just go on a little bit to the point where they begin to get on your nerves a little bit.
Yeah, they want to over-talk it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, once you say, okay, I got it, and usually that's enough.
But do you, even at this stage of your career, do you still feel insecurities and uncertainties and about your work at times?
Absolutely. I don't think you ever get to the point where, I think it's dangerous when you don't have some of that. Now, the actors are different. There's some actors who they have to worry about everything. They're always nervous, and always nervous before they go. And they have, there's certain things that they have to do in all different preparations for some people. I like to relax. I'm a person. I'm pretty much relaxed all the time, and that's what works for me. But absolutely, I think that if you don't have some times when you're concerned and thinking, oh, how am I going to do this, or this something doesn't seem right here, then that's dangerous. If you just feel like everything's just fine, I'm brilliant. I'm sailing right along. So, yes, you definitely have, I think we all have those moments where we hit a partner, we hit a snag somewhere, and we say, oh, goodness, I'm going to pull this off. Or even you may look at a project and think, well, this is really going to be something to do. I really got to have to really work extra hard at this, whatever. But overall, I'm a person who relaxes most of the time. But let me repeat again. That can be dangerous because you can get lulled into a false sense of security. And, so I think you should. I think if I were talking to any young actor, I'd say be as well prepared. If you got two lines in a project, or if you got one scene or two lines or just very, very little to do, I would treat that just like I had a major role, or I was the lead. I would recommend that attitude. That's one of the things that happens when I look at theater and I look at television and films. It's one of the dangers I've found that, I find myself not putting as much energy into it, not being as, not being as excited about things as I used to be.
Well, I would think that relaxation, though, would be really important because, I mean, you come from the theater, and the theater is one animal where there's a continuity there. You can follow it from beginning to end. But when you're on a film set and you're working on a moment or a particular scene and there's crew around you and it's kind of an unnatural situation. I mean, was that a big learning curve for you when you started to do film to get comfortable with that and the camera?
No. And the reason it hasn't been is because I've always had this ability to relax. When I first got started, I came from Cleveland. I hadn't done anything, but I had done three plays the year before. Of course, that one where I did The Favorite, and I only did it for 3 days. And then I did two full productions at the theater in 69, and then 1970 I went to New York. So that was my theater experience, except aside from the comedy that I had done, which helped a lot. But anyway, I saw Morgan Freeman in a two-character play with Billy Lee Todd. And the two of them were brilliant. And I looked at Morgan and I thought to myself, that's what I want to do someday. And then I was blessed to work with just the best of the actors that we had in New York at that time. I was lucky enough to get parts in plays. Many times I was an understudy for somebody, but I had an opportunity to watch these great performers work, and I just sat and absorbed all of that, and I learned there how they, you know, how they just handled themselves in the theater and in the rehearsals. And I saw a lot of the right things to do, and I saw a lot of the wrong things to do, and so. I had a chance to sit back and say, okay, all right, I see where the confusion can come from, and I see things I want to avoid. And so having that in mind, I enjoy what I do. I really enjoy it, and it's exciting. It's exciting to have a project and work on it and see it come to fruition. So I enjoy doing this so much that I can't imagine not relaxing.
Yeah.
Very, 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 very rare that I get tense. And if I'm tense and nervous, I haven't done my work.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, sir, that I was so pleased that I was given an opportunity to have time with you, and I really appreciate the time.
Well, thank you, Jamie, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to you, and thank you for your support all this time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, that is actor Bill Cobbs. His new movie is The Tenant, which is available on DVD now, and we'll be talking to his co-star from that movie, Michael Berryman, in just a few moments.
Cool.
It's good. He's a great actor.
Oh, it was a great interview. Really, really informative. That was really cool.
Well, thank you. He's one of those guys that, I mean, he's just like a steady presence in every movie he does. He's just endlessly reliable, no matter what.
You're absolutely.
I guess we should talk about this because we previewed it last week and we haven't talked about it yet.
Okay. Okay, I don't know. Now I'm really confused because I don't know what it is.
Well, it's The Shining. So.
Oh yeah. All right. Yeah.
Here's the story for anyone out there that doesn't know. And the word really didn't spread about this as wide as I thought it would. But there's a place called the Dryden Theater in Rochester, New York. Last year, around the time that we premiered the Kubrick series, they started making headlines because they were showing a print of Fear and Desire. And this year, they returned and they started advertising The Shining as you've never seen it before, with the ending that was cut out of it. This ending is for many people the holy grail of lost film footage because it played for a day or two in theaters across the country. Kubrick decided he wanted to cut out this 4 minutes of footage at the end of the movie, sent to Warner Brothers, and destroyed. And it's been gone ever since. We've been told it is gone for good, destroyed every last copy.
Right.
So when the Dryden Theater announced this, it was major news for the Kubrick circle of fans. And they were kind of bombarded with emails and questions. How did you get it? What's going on? Well, I guess they responded to one of the websites last week, and they said, I'm so sorry. It's a mistake on our part. We didn't mean that we have the deleted ending. We have the version that wasn't seen overseas. The American version, 141 minutes, which is 20 minutes longer than the version that Europeans saw.
Wow.
I don't buy that. I don't buy that excuse for a second.
No.
They had it. And there's no, first of all, unless you're purposely playing a trick to drum up business, there's no way that you accidentally say you have the deleted ending unless you have the deleted ending. And secondly, why would you sell it as the version that was never seen in Europe when you're screening it in New York? You're screening
right.
the version that's been seen for the past 31 years in the U.S.
Yeah.
That's exactly as you've seen it before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean...
I don't buy it. Something's going on.
Hmm. Wow.
So that footage will show up.
Okay, but, you know, speaking of The Shining, what about the Stephen King sequel?
Yeah.
What's the story with that? I mean, does anyone know what where this picks up or what it... I mean, this is
happening.
Yeah,
I mean, Danny Torrance is... works in a hospital, and vampires play a role in it, and it's called Dr. Sleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really, it doesn't really excite me. But,
yeah, it seems like an odd thing for him to do. I mean...
So it's the one character that he's always wondered what happened to them, that he wanted to write a sequel to.
Okay. We'll see.
Yeah. But, I guess it'll be interesting. So he's writing that now. I guess that'll be the big book release he has after his Kennedy assassination book.
Yeah, the Kennedy thing sounds fascinating. I have to admit that sounds pretty cool. I might purchase that in hardback. I don't know yet.
Yeah, it does sound very good.
Yeah.
Okay, I saw The Human Centipede 2.
Okay. Just spill it. Tell us about it. I haven't seen one yet, but go ahead and...
Spill it. That's a beautiful, beautiful way of saying it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You haven't seen part one?
No, I got to be honest, dude. I have no interest. But
yeah.
Who am I that I have seen
Human Centipede 1 and 2?
Well, I mean,
it's like,
you know,
so out of character.
I know, but I mean, I saw the South Park episode about Human Centipede, and I knew exactly what they're talking about. But I just, you know what, life is very short. As you get older, you can see the finish line, so you got to really pick them and choose them as you go.
Well, this one, it's really, it's obviously disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's billed as the sickest movie ever made. You know, he self-promoted it that way. Got banned. He wants people to believe that. It got banned in England. Not since Clockwork Orange. And actually, their reasoning for banning it even puts more publicity on the movie, because they said, you know, this movie can do harm. And that's a great thing to say about an exploitation movie. I mean, that'll make people want to see it more.
Right.
It's the things I like about it. I like the premise, even though I do think there's a sense in the great horror movie directors that you're not safe.
Right.
You get the sense from him in this, even though I wouldn't say he's one of the greats. But I like the premise that it's a guy that is obsessed with the first film and he wants to recreate it for himself. I like the building of the character in that you get a glimpse into what makes him psychotic.
Right.
He's disgusted. He's just the look of him. He's gigantic. He's got these bug eyes. It's a black and white movie. It's a silent performance of his. He doesn't say anything in the movie. So it really plays like he looks and feels like Peter Lorre in M. I mean, that's.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And I bet that was an inspiration for the building of the character. It does get very disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about it that is not disturbing, because it's incredibly ridiculous. Like, you're like, oh, come on. So So it doesn't get under your skin.
Well, that's good.
Or out your hole. It just if you were attuned to the first human centipede,
mm-hmm.
if that was what you're into, something you responded to, then you'll get double that with the human centipede too. So IFC is releasing it on demand and in theaters starting this Friday. We're awaiting word whether or not we have the director, Tom Six, for Wednesday night show. That'll determine if we have a Wednesday night show.
Okay.
So we'll see. We'll see. But I'm sure it'll do well. I mean, especially well, all this sickest movie ever made and banned
mm-hmm.
in England and all this kind of stuff behind it.
Right, right.
I'm sure it'll have momentum.
That's the word I was looking for, momentum.
Well, we have some good shows coming up throughout the month. It was a drought last month, and now this month it's a geyser. So we'll have Alexander Splatt, one of the best composers around. We'll have Joel Schumacher, a director we all love. We'll have Dennis Farina, one of the great character actors out there. And we'll have Antonio Banderas, a movie star, later on this month, too.
Yeah, very, very much a movie star. So speaking of movie star,
Well, the argument is, since Moneyball didn't perform like they wanted it to, and you look at Brad Pitt's resume, and a lot of his films aren't of that big box office gross quality, can you truly call him a movie star?
Well, this goes with the whole Clooney thing. I mean, this is the same
it's the
predicament
same
that Clooney's in. Well, they both have the Ocean's 11 trilogy. To their credit, but Brad Pitt actually has some more than Clooney. If you want to throw in Inglourious Basterds and Inglourious Basterds in there, but then the other movies are not, they're not blockbuster. Troy was a disappointment from what I understand.
Right.
He is not a – I mean, he is a movie – they are both movie stars in the sense that we want to treat them that, but they are not reliable box office, I guess. If that is the true definition in this day and age, they don't bring in what you would think, given their name, brand, recognition, and everything. They don't bring in including Clooney's work over the years, and has been very good. The American, Up in the Air, and so forth, all excellent performances. But and Michael Clayton especially, but they are not box office hits. And the same can be said for Brad Pitt. Although I think Moneyball is doing better than some of the other things. But I mean, one of his greatest performances is the assassination of Jesse James, and I don't think that registered with anybody outside the art house circuit. And that's truly one of his greatest performances, and just one of the greatest films. But and you look at, he's willing to take chances, though. Someone once told me, a friend of mine once said, he's a pretty boy. You really want to hate him for being a pretty boy, but it's the choices he makes that redeem him. And I think that's very true. Artistically, he makes very smart choices that, are risk at the bottom. Babel's out of them, so.
And he's known the world over. I mean, he's definitely... And he's known for being a movie star. So, I mean, he's definitely a movie star.
Yeah.
Even though his movies don't perform like your typical what you're accustomed to thinking of as a movie star's performance.
Right.
You know, who's the biggest movie star ever?
Cary Grant? Or Tom Cruise? I don't know. It's a loaded question.
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise,
do you know?
Really?
Tom Cruise's movies have grossed more than the Beatles or Elvis, or the biggest grossing in the history of entertainment. The highest gross belongs to Tom Cruise in any entertainment form.
Wow.
That makes it, that would make him the biggest movie star of all time, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Under this criteria?
Yeah. But wow. Well, okay, so, I mean... All right, because the last couple of years have not been kind to him. But I guess it doesn't matter. And he's got Mission Impossible 4 coming out, so, wow. All right, well, that's
good.
But
You know,
but he is someone who is known the world over. I mean, everyone knows who Tom Cruise is, and you know, so I mean, and when he was in his, you know, I hate to say this because he's such a young
heyday.
Guy in his heyday prime, those movies were huge.
Yeah. Well, they were cultural events too.
Yeah.
And very few actors are involved in more than, I mean, they're blessed to be involved in one. They're
mm-hmm.
so rare, but in as many of those kinds of films as Tom Cruise has been.
Right.
Like kind of, yeah, shake up, become a part of culture.
Yeah.
It's,
I mean,
you know,
Top
SNL
Gun,
will parody them.
Top Gun, Risky Business, and then a successful franchise like Mission Impossible and a controversial big hit Interview with a Vampire. I mean, we can go on and on and on, but he's, you know, I think he has it. I mean, look, I think Collateral is one of his greatest performances, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. We're going to play our final interview for the night, which is Mr. Michael Berryman, and then we'll close off with a movie theme of the week.
Okay, cool.
And I'll give you the choice of what we play, Jerry.
Okay, cool, thank you.
It's an honor. You deserve
it. It's an honor,
especially,
it is.
Yeah, especially birthday tomorrow. So
yeah,
this is my gift.
I'm letting you
choose your theme.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you.
Now, this is an interesting conversation. We started talking about The Tenant, which is this new movie, and we got into the meaning of art and growing your own food, and it went off in really fascinating directions. I've cut like 25 minutes out of this interview just because I had to, just because
right.
of time constraints for the show. But, I mean, you get the most fascinating aspects of it in this edit of it. Michael Berryman, he started his career with One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest and The Hills Have Eyes, two seminal 70s movies. The Hills Have Eyes has actually been remastered, too, on Blu-ray, and that's available now. It's an interesting conversation with Michael Berryman, so... enjoy it, guys. Let me find the file, and I'll press play on it.
Okay.
All right, here he is, guys. Enjoy it. I guess where to start would be the project, The Tenant. When it came to you, what kind of appealed to you about it?
What I liked was the scene where I meet my daughter, and... You know, I don't want to be in a straitjacket, and you know, everybody thinks I'm really bad, but there are other things going on. I thought we had some real tender moments in that scene. The version I saw was a very short version. It cut out a lot of the stuff that really I was enamored to, actually, to be quite honest.
Mm.
I think it could have been. A little more heartfelt as opposed to monster driven.
Right.
As far as the film, they have footage. I would like to see a re-edit, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a stronger experience for a wider audience.
You know what? As an actor, though, do you run into this a lot because you put your best foot forward, but in the end, I mean, you have a lack of control beyond your own contribution on the set that day. Is that something that's difficult to come to terms with?
Yes. And over the 3.5 decades that I've had the joy to be involved in filmmaking, I've had bittersweet moments and just fantastic moments. So, yes, if you don't have – if you're not editing – then you don't have complete control. But you know what? We get the footage that we need. I always bring something to the scene to help my fellow actors so we can draw from one another and grow. And that's
mm-hmm.
the art part. You know, as far as how it winds up, I would be much happier if they put the scenes back in with my daughter because I think it would have been a better film, stronger film.
You've been doing this for a long time, as you said. I mean, over 30 years. Is there a different kind of pleasure or challenge you get from the work now than when you first started?
Very interesting question. It is different because in the early years, I had been on stage with a friend of mine from high school, and we were like Simon and Garfunkel. I wrote great lyrics. We could sing. He played a wonderful Martin guitar. Having a difference visually as a child growing up, dealing with raw emotions and trying to mature and understand the world and people around you. Well, these are kind of like literature. It's kind of like stories. It's kind of things that I've read. It's like the TV shows I really appreciated. Now, don't get me wrong. I love a good action flick. I love a good silly comedy.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, you know, deeper art, I like wonderful stories with good character development. Twilight Zone comes to mind. Many chances that we have to bring more into a scene than is on the written page.
Yeah.
You know, I have seen scenes where there was almost where there was no dialogue at all. My favorite one is when Jack Nicholson is in Cuckoo's Nest, and Billy is becoming deflowered, so to speak.
Right.
And everybody's kind of waiting. It's very late. Everybody's kind of done with the dancing. Danny DeVito's asleep with the blonde. Jack has got the window unlocked, and he's waiting. And he and the chief fall asleep. And there's a beautiful moment where just before he nods out, you hear a train whistle. And he reacts to it so beautifully. And that was a live train. Or just about every night about that time in the early morning, the train would go by and we'd hear the whistle. Well, he reacted to it. Instead of just saying cut or, oh, that interfered with my scene, Jack Nicholson just, if you watch Cuckoo's Nest, and it's just a simple scene, no dialogue, but his reaction, and you can read on his face, and he does a very simple smile and a sigh. And then the editor cuts to
the next morning.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful movie. I mean, it's one of the most gorgeous movies I've ever seen in my life. But you bring up an interesting point, because in that scene, Milos Forman gave him the time to show him in thought, to show him thinking. The movie kind of slowed down and just held onto that shot of him thinking, and that's so rare for films.
Wow, you're spot on. That was just an excellent observation and question and comment. Thank you for that, and for our listening audience. Yes, that's precisely what he did. Now, for those who might not be familiar with Milos Forman's work, he had to leave his mother country because he made a movie that made fun of the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the reason for making the film. It's called The Fireman's Ball. Anyone who is into filmmaking or film history or screenwriting or acting, look up The Fireman's Ball, directed by Milos Forman. Now, carry that sensitivity on as an artist to how he was chosen and why. That was the reason why. Also, Tinker Follies, because Tinker Follies is about, well, it was one of the earliest documentaries that I'm aware of about how they force feed through the nose and very much abused mental patients were the last, lower on the totem pole, below prisoners as far as being treated humanely. So, again, that goes right up to Ken Kesey's Cuckoo's Nest and where we were with the story we had to tell. It was vindictiveness of the nurse to lobotomize Mr. McMurphy.
Yeah.
So when I was first on the set, I remember speaking with Milos. We had 2 weeks of rehearsals with carbon arc lighting and camera. And I said, please give me some direction. This is early for me. And he said, have a love affair with this lens. Walked me up to a Panavision camera and said, this is what captures the magic. This is what you have to have emotional response to. And he was right. And you're absolutely correct. with your observation about what he allowed Jack Nicholson to do in that very, very simple scene that is stunning.
Yeah. And you know what else about the film, and I know this has to be a rarity, is that you were, if I'm not mistaken, there was no escape from it. I mean, you were in those living quarters, you felt it in your marrow, and that translated into the film. That has to be a rare experience.
It was extremely artistic and rare, as you described, yes. We had 2 weeks of rehearsals with camera, and we were 6 days a week in a real real mental hospital. They performed a lobotomy while we were there.
Mm.
They tried to hide it, but you know, you got millions of dollars in a movie company and locals. Guess what? It was to the marrow. Absolutely, absolutely. We spent so much time. Well, during the first 2 weeks, we would spend one actor in one room with the patient for 1 hour. Mm. And then on the next day, you would be with a different type of patient on a different level. And we're talking either criminally insane or geriatric or, you know, there's different levels of maintenance for the mentally challenged. The running joke, of course, was that they would, you know, each give us our own permanent room at Oregon State Hospital. But it got to wear on us after a while. Yes, it did.
Oh, I bet.
And it helped.
But going from that atmosphere of complete immersion, how did that kind of develop your own style of building a character that you carried over into your other movies?
Well, it was very challenging because I was, you know, a full frontal lobotomy patient. However, I every day at work on Cuckoo's Nest set, there were people visiting the set that were friends of the producers, Michael Douglas, the director, Jack Nicholson, and others from all over the world, and the international press corps that did cover film were there on any given day, and I was in Oregon for 127 days. So my job description was lobotomy. However, my job location was the most beautiful, wonderful, most supportive and film school I could have attended.
Yes.
And then, you know, after that I went to do Pluto and Hills Have Eyes. I would say empathy is what really was brought to the forefront from the Cuckoo's Nest experience.
You know, I love that you use that word because when I think of the great actors and the great performances, I think what they all have in common is a tremendous empathy. And I think that goes with artists in general.
Of course. I have a degree in art history. I took every class I had at Cal Poly, California State University in San Luis Obispo, a beautiful, beautiful campus, wonderful place to be. I took everything except sculpture and pottery. Maybe clothing design didn't do that one. But art history, studying the master's works, the work of Joseph Albers, for understanding color. He did squares upon squares. It's in your art history books, from Gauguin to Da Vinci, you name it. If you're ever in Florida, go to St. Petersburg. Go to the permanent Salvador Dali Art Museum.
That's 45 minutes away from me. That's where I live.
And it survived every hurricane that's been around it. I mean,
right.
What a beautiful experience. Large, large canvases and panels. And then I love Paul Klee, his work, and he was very much involved in music. Good grief. Philip Rothko, I mean, you name it. Without art, we would be very, well, I would say we would be very cheated. I was going to say we would be very disappointed, but if you don't know what the potential for a quality of life is, that's a sad day.
Yeah. You know, and there's also something about artists. You can always tell where we are as a society by looking to the work of our artists. And
absolutely. Absolutely. A perfect example would be, labor history depicted through art over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You can go all the way back to stone carvings, to wooden effigies, to tapestries, to bronzes, to historical reenactments of military battles, because they're reflecting, you know, great leaders, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you're absolutely correct. I would say when our art was the worst was probably right around the mid-1950s.
Mm.
It was banal. It was flat. It was dead. It was crepe paper. Had no life to it. You know. Now
so
today you could do a work of art with that perspective, and someone would go at a gallery go, oh my goodness, I see what you're doing. Now I remember conversations listening to people like Andy Warhol and others in the Dada movement, where. And like Marcel Duchamp, for instance, Nude Descending the Staircase, there were people in the galleries in New York going, well, where's the nude? Well, that's joke. We're talking about, because that was post-industrial revolution. They were trying to express, the artist is always there, regardless of the medium, music, dance, sculpture, you name it, painting, film. We love our. We should always love and appreciate our artists. Imagine this: someone should do a short. Well, I actually saw one at the Calgary Film Festival about. The subject matter was about the worst possible conditions on Earth in a war zone on planet Earth today, and people still have art. Doesn't make everything go away and be better, and it doesn't really give them solace. But it's still a reflection of what their experience is. That is
yes.
The true purpose of art.
We went from The Tenant, and we really took a terrific U-turn here. It's wonderful.
Oh, I did it on purpose. Look, The Tenant is look, you should quote. And Lee, I love you, but you know what? The Tenant was edited in a manner of which I am displeased.
Yeah.
The higher
vibration
of the drama and the acting and what was there and it was available and is on film was subjugated and given away for egocentric reasons for somebody else to go, oh, look, I'm a star, and I'm not talking
right.
about me, and I'm going to be
right.
polite and stop there. It could be re-edited and be much stronger. And I will defend my art. I will defend my efforts, and I will defend the original intent of the writer to tell a story. See, what people need to address and understand and appreciate is that you can have a great story, but from that page, those stack of pages, to when someone gets popcorn and watches the end result, it can be influenced by many, 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 many people, and some of those people are financiers who are not artists.
Right. You know, we've spoken with, you know, I've done about 600 interviews for the show, and I... The thing I love most is talking about the power of cinema, because for me, movies are a way to kind of get connected to my humanity and feel connection with something outside of myself and with other people. You know, but
wow,
the most
poignant thing I've heard in many days.
But the most depressing.
That's awesome.
I will tell you, the most depressing conversation interview I've ever done for the show were two people. They came from the business realm. They were starting their own studio. They bought a couple of properties. And the reason why it was so depressing was because it was very clear to me that these people did not love movies. They had no business making them. And that kind of mentality has taken over somewhat the world of filmmaking.
Hey, look, and I don't care if they hear this because I know they won't, and if they do, they know I'm right. Perfect example, Saw. There is no purpose for that film to ever be made. Oh, but it's a billion-dollar franchise. Big whoop. I remember back in the late 50s and early 60s, there were movies called Mondo slash films.
Mm-hmm.
These were like the taboo films of the era. There's always been that throughout recorded history. Ooh, don't do that, don't go there, you know. And they're designed to basically put money in somebody's pocket for shock value. What you do and what you create defines you. It's kind of like, you know, take a few lessons from Jerry Maguire. If you wake up groggy, you don't need these patent medicines.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get out there, eat right, eat healthy. You know what? We have a way to end childhood obesity. It's so bloody obvious. We have all these fast food restaurants. You know, people, you've made your billions. All we ask for you is to just put in food that will sustain you.
Yes.
You have a distribution center. It doesn't have to. You don't have to ship cardboard. And look, I was a meat cutter in college. Yesterday morning, I was the day before yesterday, I was in Calgary, Alberta, taking a walk, and two gentlemen recognized me and said, "Would you join me for breakfast?" I had breakfast with them, and lo and behold, they were in the meat industry. And one guy was older, one guy was younger, and I started to talk about what it was like in the early 70s, in the late 70s, when I was a butcher at a wholesale meatpacking plant in San Luis Obispo while I was going to college. And I was discussing with him about how the industry had changed. You know, do you realize that people in industries, they're not bribes, but money changes hands to another pile of money somewhere else in another office. It helps people pay for campaigning, and that's okay. But you can't tell me there's no such thing as influence. Long story short, to save a few bucks, they've passed laws or passed ordinances and make it allowed to where you can put a little more poison or make this a little bit less nutrition, and it's okay. Wait a minute.
What I'm afraid of,
it goes
back to the fast food on every corner. If that's the only diet that is being shoved down people's throats, for me it correlates to film. If the only thing on the menu is the dumbed-down blockbuster, that's the kind of society you're grooming, a society that feels too little, thinks too little.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So for you, I guess I want to get back to just a movie question before we close.
We could go on for weeks. Hey, we should do a cable show.
I think we really should. That would be terrific. For you and your
My people.
I will do that. I will do that. For you in your life, talking about the power of art and the power of cinema, what are the essential movies that have enriched your life?
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. Let me give it a good thought. This Island Earth, At Play in the Fields of the Lord.
Wow, yeah.
Matinee. Thank you, John Goodman.
That's it.
And I had breakfast with Joe Dante one morning. He joined me for breakfast at a convention. You should go to conventions, listeners. You'll love it. And we had a wonderful, wonderful experience sharing about that movie. Blade Runner, of course. Let me give you one more. Because I'm trying to go into a different genre. How about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
That would be on my list too. Absolutely.
Change
that was the first movie that made me love movies, actually.
Oh.
So that movie means a lot to me. So I thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
So tell me about upcoming, before we close, I want to give you a chance to tell me about upcoming projects that you're most excited about that our listeners should look out for.
Well, the one I would really much appreciate as much support as possible worldwide, I want everyone to go to Facebook to Below Zero and put in a shout to Signe Olnick and Bob Schultz. And you can put in a attaboy and girl to Eddie Furlong, Kristen Booth, and that Michael Berryman does a wonderful character named Gunner. And I would like to promote that. The other projects I'm super excited about, I'm looking at on my desk, and they're all top secret, and I'm not allowed to talk about them.
All right.
I really want to, but it's not time yet.
When those projects come to fruition, would you will you please come back and tell
Absolutely.
Me tell
Are you
me
kidding?
About?
Hey, I appreciate every word you're allowing me to say on in this format, and I'm very grateful for being able to have a soapbox.
Okay, that is Michael Berryman from Cuckoo's Nest, Hills Have Eyes, and his new movie, The Tenant, which is on DVD now. So
that
I guess he
awesome,
has reservations.
Wow.
He has reservations about The Tenant, apparently. he didn't mind sharing them. But there you go. I mean, it's your choice out there. The Tenant's available. You can purchase it from our website. It's a Berryman, Bill Cobb's movie.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Okay. Good month. Our next episode of the Kubrick series at the end of the month concerning The Shining. Antonio Medeiros later on in the month. Joel Schumacher. We have some good shows coming up, and the authors of new books involving about Pauline Kael,
mm-hmm.
and Arthur Penn and Raoul Walsh, and just good stuff coming up this month.
Cool.
Tell me a Raoul Walsh movie.
High Sierra.
Okay. The test is over. You didn't even give me time to play a Jeopardy theme, man.
Oh,
look,
okay. Sorry. I'm sorry. That was the first thing I thought of. So.
And this is not the Polanski, The Tenant. It's a
new yeah, movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'll give you a choice, Jerry, of what song we close out with here.
Okay.
We have the theme from Buckaroo Banzai.
Mm-hmm.
The theme from The Illustrated Man. Well, that's really it.
Let's do The Illustrated Man, because I don't even know that. So, I mean, I've seen the movie a long time ago, but let's do that. I mean,
it's very pretty.
Okay, cool.
It's the Bradbury, Ray Bradbury. Right?
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. I mean, let's do that.
Okay. All righty. So All right. We will see you Wednesday night if we book the director of. One of the most controversial directors out there, Tom Six. If we book him for Wednesday night, then we'll be back Wednesday night. If not, we'll be back Sunday with Joel Schumacher.
Cool.
Here is The Illustrated Man. Jerry, have a very happy birthday tomorrow.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you very much. Thanks.
All of our listeners out there, flood Jerry with birthday wishes. Flood him.
Okay.
I want him drowning in it.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Thank you, and everyone have a great week, and we will see you hopefully Wednesday night.
Bye-bye, guys. Thank
Bye.
You, Jerry. Thank you.